This is an ABC podcast.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Yes, we all know why we're singing that and bopping along to that at the moment. It is, of course, David Attenborough's 100th birthday, and we are continuing the celebrations. 1300 222 774 is the number to call to join me to talk about David Attenborough. But maybe, how do you feel about milestone birthdays? Have you ever had one hijacked? Because apparently, I think that's how David Attenborough feels. Good luck with that. You're never going to get away with a quiet birthday, David Attenborough. I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. Happy Friday. Happy David Attenborough Appreciation Day today. A century since he was born, I think it's safe to argue that his work has changed the lives of everyone on this planet simply because of his towering work promoting the health of this planet. Such an incredible legacy. Let's hear a little from the man himself.
I had rather thought that I would celebrate my 100th birthday quietly, but it seems that many of you have had other ideas. I've been completely overwhelmed by birthday greetings, from preschool groups to care home residents and countless individuals and families of all ages. I simply can't reply to each of you all separately, but I would like to thank you all most sincerely for your kind messages and wish those of you who have planned your own local events tomorrow have a very happy day.
Poor Sir David. Have you ever had a milestone birthday hijacked? I'd love to hear your tales of good surprises, maybe bad surprises for those milestones. 1300 222 774 is the number to call, or 0437 774 774 is the number to text. Do you love to celebrate a milestone birthday? Maybe you don't like that. Or maybe you had a really great milestone birthday. Tell me what you did. What do you do when you want to avoid everyone coming in and going over the top? This from JP in Ashwood. At my aunt's 80th birthday, we'd all sat down for lunch and my brother-in-law tinkled his glass to get everyone's attention. We thought he was about to do a toast to my aunt, but instead went on to tell everyone that he had an announcement: prostate cancer. Fortunately, he's okay, but the timing? Asks JP. Yes, that seems like bad timing. Have you ever had a milestone birthday like that? Do join the conversation. It's going to be a fun hour. We're going to be speaking soon to a man who admits he shamelessly used David Attenborough for his own purposes. It did all work out well. And we are going to examine David Attenborough's legacy to broadcasting, documentaries, how he's inspired even our youngest generations. That's all coming up. 1300 222 774 if you'd like to call in. How do you celebrate a milestone birthday? Do you love them? Do you hate them? Tiffany, you've called in from Dingley Village. What's your story?
My husband isn't a big party person. He doesn't like parties, but I am. He's married someone who loves celebrating, and I love him, and my girls and I adore him, and we just want to celebrate him, but it's not his thing. His 30th, I gave him a big surprise party. Yeah. Which he enjoys, but he doesn't love it. His 40th, I talked him into having another party. 50, he was able to get away with. We just went away for the weekend, but it's coming up to his 60th.
Ooh, and what have you got planned? Yeah,
well, I was planning to do a party and maybe just a small sort of gathering at a brewery, but he's like, nah, don't want to do it. So now we're doing, this is the thing, now we're doing like half a dozen little celebrations.
So a little bit for everybody there. Are you happy enough about that, Tiffany? Or, you know, is the urge for that last minute surprise going to overtake you?
Well, no, I think he'd divorce me.
Well, you've lasted through the good times and the bad times when it comes for the birthdays.
I have.
You have, Tiffany. Sounds like a perfect compromise. Well done to you.
Eddie.
Yes.
Thanks,
and happy 60th to your hubby.
To Chris.
Good on you, Chris. Happy birthday
Thank
from
you.
Me. Sorry if this is
Thanks,
too much.
Mary.
Okay. Bye. Tell me, are you like Tiffany? Do you have to manage that within your partnership? We're talking about birthdays because of Sir David Attenborough. We're going to keep talking about him, but also tell me your stories. Also this hour, we're going to be talking about the Iranian attacks on US ships and counterattacks. Just in the past couple of hours, that's come out. Donald Trump says the ceasefire is still on. The Iranian attacks were just a, quote, love tap. Apparently, official language around the war is changing. So we will dig into that because we still do need to keep an eye on that. We're also going to meet a man who went from car salesman to saving thousands of lives. But next, let's meet the man who's met Sir David and even used his name.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 11 minutes past 11. This on text, is there any public figure with a higher poll rating than Attenborough? It's a really good question. We're looking at his legacy as he turns 100. His influence stretches from the living rooms to the laboratories. And one measure of his significance is that 50 species have been named in honour of just his birthday. That's got to be the measure of someone, doesn't it? From our very own Royal Botanic Gardens in Victoria, botanist Dr. Alistair Robinson is part of the Attenborough story. He co-discovered and named one of the world's most remarkable plants, naming it in Attenborough's honour, even though he isn't a fan of doing that. So here to tell us why and how that all came about, he joins us now. Hi, Alistair.
Hi, Mary. Thank you for having me on air.
Our pleasure. Look, we'll talk about your close encounter with David Attenborough in just a moment. Let's go back to the beginning of this story. You discover plants, which I just have to say is a pretty cool thing to talk about in anyone's life. Take us back to that moment of discovery. Where were you? What did you realise that you'd found?
Absolutely. So back in 2007, I was exploring the Philippines and made the first documented ascent by a botanist to the summit of a mountain called Mount Victoria in Palawan, the Philippines. Long story short, up at the top of the mountain, we found one of the largest carnivorous plants on the planet, and it is the tropical pitch plant that would eventually be named Nepenthes attenboroughi.
Mm-hmm.
We decided to name the plant after Sir David Attenborough, simply given how much of an inspiration he had been to us and most other naturalists, I think, frankly. And he also once declared that Nepenthes, these tropical pitcher plants, were one of his favorite plants. So commemorating him with an especially remarkable species seemed like the right thing to do. But as you've alluded to, there was an element of strategy there.
Okay. So first off, I just have to ask about a carnivorous pitcher plant. I'd love to get a picture, as I say, of the pitcher plant and also the reason why you wouldn't name a carnivorous plant after Audrey 2 from The Little Shop of Horrors. Did that never cross your mind?
Absolutely, it did. That was actually a childhood favorite movie. But basically
your career.
Carnivorous plants are plants that are able to attract, trap and digest animals. And there's a whole host of different ones. And in fact, Australia's got the largest number of carnivorous plant species of any region in the world. But many people don't realize that.
I didn't. Where would we find them?
The best place is Western Australia, but you get them all across Victoria as well. The really common ones here are sundews. They're sticky plants that adhere insects to their leaves and then digest them like that.
Wow.
But the tropical pitcher plants are something else entirely. They occur from Madagascar across to Southeast Asia and New Guinea and also far north Queensland. And they have leaves that are modified into pitchers. And these are essentially like open stomachs. They're able to digest the things that they trap inside their leaves. And they're pretty amazing plants.
Absolutely amazing. This could be a whole other topic in itself. You're listening to Dr. Alistair Robinson, who's a botanist at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Victoria. We are, though, talking about David Attenborough today, and you have had that close encounter. So you weren't a fan of naming plants after people. Why?
That's exactly right. So I don't know. For me, I'm originally from Malaysia, which is it was colonized by the Brits, and there's a sort of a colonial history of naming plants after people. And so I've always gravitated towards naming plants after their characteristics, where they occur. And I'd never named a plant after a person before. But when it was suggested that maybe David Attenborough should be commemorated with a plant that he likes, I was like, oh. And then talking to the traditional owners who helped guide us up the mountain, they were like, oh, do you know what? A famous name attached to this plant might be good for us because there's been mining at the base of this mountain where the plant's found, and it could help draw attention to the conservation plight that we're trying to raise here. And in the end, it was really good advice because obviously it got on the news. I ended up meeting him because the BBC asked me to talk about it with him on air, which was mind-blowing. But
you confessed to him that you'd used and abused his name.
That's absolutely right. So I admitted that to him off air on the One Show in the BBC programme. And he took it really well. He joked that there are certain circumstances within which it is okay to be used and not to feel awkward about it. And he was really touched by the fact that the plant, as a result of the name, became the floral emblem for the municipality where the mountain is found. And although the mountain hasn't yet been protected, this plant is one of the sort of poster children of the biodiversity up there. And if the mountain ends up protected in any small way because of this name choice, it would be, you know, a highlight of my life and, you know, certainly something to be proud of.
Oh, that's extraordinary. I mean, the power of David Attenborough's name and yes, your cleverness in actually doing it, that really does go to the extent of his legacy, doesn't it? When it's not even about what he has discovered, it's about the inspiration it gives to everyone else and amplifying what you do.
Absolutely. And in fact, I hadn't heard the message that you played earlier. I mean, he's such a charismatic and charming person. And he really manages to touch a lot of people who he's never met in person. He's actually come here to Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, the Crandon site. I think he came by helicopter. This was back in 1995. This is sort of anecdotal, but apparently there was some flooding there and he had to be fitted with a pair of gum boots. And word on the street is that he wears a size 14, which is enormous. So he quite literally has big shoes to fill. And I think he really inspires a lot of people towards an appreciation of the natural world.
We are talking about David Attenborough and the natural world. You're listening to Dr. Alistair Robinson. We're also talking about big milestone birthdays because apparently Sir David wanted a quiet one. Good luck with that. I'm asking you, what do you do for a milestone birthday? Do you like to keep your head down? Do you like to have a party? Maybe you've had yours hijacked as well. Emily, you've called in from Moi. What's your story?
Hi. My husband David turned 50 in August 2024, and we decided to rent a house in New Orleans because we really like music and blues music. And we rented a house for the full month of August that was 6 bedrooms. It slept about 15 people. And we just invited it to friends and family who, if they wanted to come over, they had accommodation there, they could come. And we had different groups of people come. Different people came for, you know, 3 or 4 days and then did a bit of a US trip. Or
sounds delightful.
Stayed. Like my dad came for 3 weeks and my sister came and Dave's family, sisters.
Wow,
and brother
sounds amazing.
Came, and we had like and every time a new person arrived, it was like, oh, happy birthday, Dave, again. And it was another night out on the town and it was another night, you know, seeing music and listening to things. And then, oh, they're leaving tomorrow, so we've got to have another party tonight to say,
oh, the festival.
Oh, you're going. And then it was, yeah, it was the festival of Dave. And we did lots of different touristy stuff. And, you know, the house was amazing. And, you know, yeah, we had a really good time. We had cousins.
That sounds
and
like the
and
most. How can you ever beat that, Emily?
I know. It's and we keep on saying we need to go back there again and do it. We need to go back there again and do it. But yeah.
Can you ever have that same festival though? Emily, no. I think you've given inspiration to a whole heap of people.
It was great. And it wasn't actually as expensive as you think to rent a house for a month. Like it was pretty cost of, as if you're looking at like getting a hotel for people every night, for that amount of people, like we worked it out. That it was actually quite a good way of doing it.
How soon until Dave's 60th?
So that was 2 years ago.
Oh, okay. So you're looking at the 70th.
Yeah, So we'll have to do 60th maybe in somewhere. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe go back there.
Maybe go back. Can we ever go back to those festivals? Thank you, Emily. Thanks for calling in. I also want to hear your stories of milestones. Maybe the milestone birthday you didn't want to acknowledge, but maybe someone did. Harley, you've called in from Lara. Tell me about the milestone in your life.
Hello, Mary. I turned 50 in 2 years' time, and I've actually booked to swim the English Channel on my birthday.
What? Okay, yeah. That's a plan. So you're training, obviously, Harley.
Yes, absolutely.
Why did you want to do that?
As a kid, I was a keen swimmer. And it's always been something that has interested me.
Mm-hmm.
I read a book by Brendan Cullen, who has recently, it's been just released, about his struggles with mental health and swimming the channel, and it really struck a chord.
Oh, Harley,
and I thought, yeah.
Why not? That's going to make you feel younger than 50, or maybe a lot older. I'm not sure.
maybe a lot older for a couple of weeks.
For a couple of weeks. Harley, good on you. I'm getting some inspirational calls this morning about milestones. Are you like Harley? Are you planning for a really big milestone? You can do it by yourself swimming a channel if you like. You can do it anywhere you like Emily, with a whole heap of people. Kindly still hanging on the line, though, Dr. Alistair Robinson, who has met David Attenborough, who used and abused his name. Just to finish off on David Attenborough, on his 100th birthday, Alistair, what do you think, if you can name David Attenborough's greatest contribution, whether to yourself or to the planet?
Oh, I've been watching his documentary since I was a youngling. Wildlife on One was a childhood favorite. And I don't think I'm unique in that. He's managed to reach out to so many people across the decades, inspiring us to care about our planet, which is precious and, finite. So I think that's his greatest achievement. And I think it's probably the legacy he's most likely to be proud of.
Exactly. Dr. Alistair Robinson, thank you for joining in the celebration today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Mary.
Dr. Alistair Robinson is Manager of Biodiversity Services and a botanist at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Victoria. You are texting in with all of your milestone stories. We will get back to that. And we thought we'd take a big look at what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz. There's been attacks, counterattacks, but apparently the ceasefire is still going.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Keep those stories of hijacked milestone birthdays coming. We will get back to those. But we wanted to have a look at what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz. The US conducted self-defense strikes against Iranian targets after Iran fired at US destroyers. But the president has described the Iranian fire as just a love tap. Here to try to explain that is Jessica Genauer, who is global conflict researcher at University of New South Wales. Thanks for joining us, Jessica.
My pleasure.
What do we know about these attacks and counterattacks?
So essentially what we've seen is another sort of series of tit-for-tat strikes between the Iranian regime and the US military. So each side are saying that the other side started it first and that they were the ones sort of acting out of self-defense. But we have had these attacks on a US Navy ship. We think these were sort of what we'll call kind of asymmetric attacks, so looking at drones and fast attack speedboats, but as well as your more conventional cruise missiles, and that then the US responded by shooting back at the places from where those attacks were coming. And this is really just part of the general picture of ongoing trade of fire in and around the Strait of Hormuz, which is quite dangerous and risky, at the same time as we have this sort of shaky ceasefire which is holding. And
is it? Do we still think it is a ceasefire?
So it is a ceasefire in the sense that the US has not gone back to full-scale war against Iran, which would mean massive US airstrikes against Iran, such as we saw in the first weeks of this war, US and Israel, I should say. Mm. So the ceasefire is holding in that regard, in that we haven't seen that return to full-scale war. But at the same time, the Strait of Hormuz is definitely a flashpoint where we are seeing daily violence, which some people would say, well, that actually violates the ceasefire. But I think what's happening in terms of the bigger picture is that Trump wants that overall ceasefire to hold, which is why he's been trying to downplay in some ways the significance of this recent violence. But he doesn't really have a way to resolve what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz, where there is a bit of now a kind of a flashpoint between the Iranian regime and the US.
Indeed. You're listening to Dr. Jessica Genau. We're talking about what's happening in the Iranian war. You talk about the fact that, you know, we're waiting to see what happens in the Strait, and that has an effect on the peace deal. Donald Trump has threatened more strikes if Iran doesn't agree to a peace deal fast, quote unquote. But when there is this stalemate in the Strait, what effect does that have on the peace deal at the moment?
Yeah, so it's quite a tricky situation. And the main thing that gives me confidence that the ceasefire actually will continue to hold is that I think that that is what Trump wants now, like that he can really see that a full-scale escalation and return to full-scale war has more costs for him than benefits, particularly in terms of what that means for him domestically within the US political context, where a lot of people are not in favour of the US, you know, getting involved in a long war in the Middle East. So I think that what we will see is that the ceasefire will continue, and there might be some kind of a deal, or at least an agreement to continue talking is probably the best case scenario for what we're going to see coming out of that. The Iranian regime staying in control inside Iran. But I think it's going to be quite a long time before we see a clear resolution to what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz. So I think we'll see a ceasefire, but for quite a few months, if not the rest of this year, we'll still see that contest over the Strait of Hormuz between the US military and the Iranian regime. And that's, of course, you know, not good news for us around the world and not good news for global shipping and supply chains.
So we're facing a fair few months there, Jessica. Before I let you go, there was this one-page memo that was produced that essentially was saying, we are going to talk bit further about the plan, and this is the plan. Essentially, are we looking at months and months of kicking the can down the road?
I do think that we are at this stage, just because the Iranian regime and the Trump administration are so far apart on critical key issues that are driving this conflict. So things like the nuclear issue, they're sitting really far apart, the lifting of sanctions on Iran, what's going to happen in the Strait of Hormuz, and then, of course, Israel's war with Hezbollah that's been included as part of this on the Iranian side. So I don't think we're going to see any sort of substantive agreement. But because Trump, I think, by now wants a ceasefire, and he particularly wants to be able to say that he got, quote unquote, a deal or some kind of agreement, I think he'll take, you know, a piece of paper like a memorandum of understanding, which is essentially saying we're agreeing to keep talking for another month, and we'll probably say, look, this is really quite a good deal, or it's the beginnings of a very good deal, but without actually having agreement on the substantive issues that have been driving this conflict in the first place. So I think that will take months, if not years, I would say. Like, I'm not sure that the Iranian regime and the Trump administration are ever going to be able to come to a full agreement around those trickier, more challenging issues.
A hard thing to hear, but yes, thank you for keeping an eye on it and explaining it to us today.
Thanks for having me on the program.
That's Dr. Jessica Genauer, who is Global Conflict Researcher at University of New South Wales. Tell me what you think of that, what you make of that situation. Tell me about those milestone birthdays in your life that were hijacked potentially. You know, David Attenborough wanted a quiet one. He was never going to get it. Sue from Essendon, what's your story?
Oh, good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
My story is I'm English born and bred, but love living in this country for the last 50 years. My sister lives in Canada. My brothers and all the rest of my family live in England. And when I turned 60, it was planned that maybe I go over there for my 60th birthday, saved having a party here. Mm-hmm. And it's around Christmas. So my sister from Canada, my brothers from England, plus all the various children and offspring, all gathered in a walking lodge in South Wales, which was just marvellous.
Oh, lovely.
And it was the first time that the four of us siblings had been together around Christmas for 40 years.
Wow. So
that was a special birthday, and now we did it for my 70th. And as my 80th approaches in a year or two, the plans are being set in motion to repeat the exercise.
Oh, Sue, that is absolutely wonderful.
It certainly was, and it started to bring the family even closer together, which is quite tricky sometimes when you're miles and miles apart. So thank you for listening to me.
Oh, Sue, thank you for calling in. I love those stories. And when it comes, eventually, happy birthday from all of us as well. Thanks for calling in. Lisa, you've called in from Caulfield. What's your milestone story?
So my husband is now 75. For his 70th birthday, we organised for him to run his 200th marathon. But unfortunately, it was 5 years ago in the middle of COVID. It had to be postponed twice. So it was hijacked there. But he was a torchbearer for the Sydney Olympics because he'd had polio as a child. And at that stage, he'd run 99 marathons. So he met the criteria to have achieved against all odds.
Wow. Look what he's had to overcome. So when did he get his 100th?
Oh, his 100th was in Ireland, but this was his 200th.
This is 200th. Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, that is. Is he still running?
He's still running, but he's a bit slower now. But he does still run, yes.
And what about you, Lisa? Do you like milestone birthdays? Do you celebrate like this?
I stand at the end of marathons waving and cheering. That's my contribution.
Good on you, Lisa. Thank you so much for calling. 1300 222 774. If you'd like to call with your milestone story, of course, we're talking about that because it is David Attenborough's century. It's his. We've had a century of David Attenborough, and we are better off. We're going to continue talking about him today. He wanted a quiet one. He didn't get it. What do you think of milestone birthdays? Anne in Hoppers Crossing, it's your birthday today as well. Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, happy birthday. Do you mind me asking, is it a milestone birthday?
No. It was last year, but it's not this year.
Okay. And you've met David Attenborough as well?
Yes. At the ABC shop in Melbourne, and it was actually on his birthday, on our birthday.
On your birthdays? Did you walk up to him and say, hey, I know it's your birthday, it's mine too?
Oh, because I got a book signed, so I said, oh, happy birthday to him. And I said, oh, it's my birthday too. And he didn't really react, and I thought, But then I was thinking about it later, and I thought, he was probably on remote. He wasn't even thinking because so many people going through, he wasn't really paying attention to what people were saying. So I wasn't really insulted when I thought about that. So, yeah.
Was it good to meet him or at least be in the same room with him?
Yes, I mean, he's such an amazing person. He's done so much good for the planet. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, what are you doing for your birthday, Anne?
Nothing really. Oh, actually, I'm going to see Ralph McTell this evening, so at the Melbourne Recital Centre, so that'll be good.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, well,
yes.
It's not a milestone, but that sounds like a lovely birthday, Anne. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you very much.
That's Anne celebrating with David Attenborough today. We are all celebrating David Attenborough today. Katie from Bendigo said, I'm looking at my signed copy of Private Life of Plants. David Attenborough is a true gentleman. He asked about my interests and I said I loved bushwalking and taking in the flora and fauna, but it was just a hobby. And he replied, my dear, it is my favourite hobby. That is fantastic and does reflect what everyone says about David Attenborough, that he's just so charming. So charming, so humble, didn't want a big deal about his 100th birthday. Good luck with that, Sir David. Mary in Sandringham, tell us about the milestone birthday that you organised or that was organised for you.
Yes, it was organised for me. My brother organised it at the Sandringham Yacht Club. My youngest son, unbeknownst to me, organised a limo. Mm. And my five closest friends that I didn't know he was doing, and they all arrived, and the limo arrived. And it was lovely. And my daughter-in-law made me a banner that said OBE for over bloody 80.
Good on you. You got an OBE on your birthday as well. Where'd you go?
Sandringham Yacht Club, yep. Which is just around the corner from where I live. So the limo had to drive around the block a few times.
Did your friends tell you to get into limo-worthy dress?
Well, I was sort of dressed up anyway because it was a special day.
Oh, terrific. So you're not like David Attenborough. You didn't mind a big deal.
No, it was lovely. I had a lot of people there.
And when I shouldn't ask when your next milestone birthday is, but you wouldn't mind having another birthday like that, I'm sure.
Yeah, that I'd have to wait 7 years. I might have fallen off the twig by then.
Oh, Mary, no. Maybe we don't have to wait for milestones to have limos. Let's start that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, good idea.
Mary, thank you so much for calling in. Are you like Mary? Have you enjoyed a surprise milestone? 1300 222 774, or maybe you've had it hijacked like David Attenborough's did. This from Judy. A friend and I went to Great Barrier Reef for my 60th. Friend hates boats, so I did the cruise on my own. Topped it off with a splendid helicopter flight. The next day we visited somewhere which had concession entry, but I hadn't received my senior's card yet. The lady was from Victoria and let me use my driver's license to prove I was 60 to get the concession. We nearly chuckle about it nearly 19 years later. Sounds terrific. A great milestone. Sounds, Judy, like you're planning another milestone soon? Maybe. I'd love to hear about that. Hi, Mary, says Karen. My 60th big birthday party was hijacked by the very first COVID-19 lockdown. Oh, the party was to be on the very first day of lockdown. My son and family had a sneaky dinner for me. We were outside, careful not to get too close to each other. Love that, Karen. Yes, so many big milestones and other events were interrupted in that time. I hope everyone has had to have a big makeup milestone party. It is coming up to 23 minutes to 12. Keep those calls and texts coming about those milestone birthdays. But next, let's have another look at David Attenborough. He's contributed in so many ways. Let's look at him through the lens of what he's done for broadcasting and documentaries.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
We are talking about birthday parties, milestones, and David Attenborough, of course, and among his many, many legacies that he is leaving, he's only 100, he's not gone yet, is, of course, what he has done for documentaries. We know him through that. He's inspired generations. We're going to be speaking to a very young man who was inspired by the documentaries. But joining me now is Ewan Ritchie, Professor of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin University, to talk through other ways exactly what he has done for the broadcast world. Hi, Ewan.
Good morning, Mary.
I want to start where it all began for Monty Python. There's a link, isn't there? Can you remind us what the link is between David Attenborough and Monty Python?
Sure. Well, I mean, basically, he was a producer at BBC and not, you know, engaging in what he's most famous for now, which is wildlife documentaries. And he was the one that basically green-lighted the famous Monty Python's Flying Circus. So for those people who know those series of sketches, which are just unbelievably funny, and, of course, we all know about Monty Python now. They're icons in the comedy world.
I would really hope that they're doing some sort of tribute to him.
I say too.
Yeah, exactly. The connection I was hearing this morning on Breakfast They Played a Grab, where you know, he almost didn't become a broadcaster because some boss thought he had teeth that were too large. He's been, though, since that rocky start, such a gift to the world in terms of broadcasting and documentaries, hasn't he?
Yeah, he absolutely has been. I mean, I think it's fair to say that he really did bring the natural world to the masses, you know. So scores and scores and scores of documentaries that cover the world, that cover just an extraordinary number of species, and not just the big and charismatic, but, you know, tiny insects, plants, fungi, parasites, all the wonderful things that occur in the natural world. He's really brought that, you know, to our screens and given them a voice. And we've fallen in love with the stories that he's told and the way that he's told them, you know. So I think his really special style of being quite understated and not making himself, you know, the sort of focus of some of those stories. I think it's fair to say that, you know, in some more recent documentaries, the sort of host often tends to be the real focus, but David absolutely takes a back seat. And, you know, he's really informative and clear, but the focus is very much on the stories that are unfolding in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously backed up by incredible cinematographers.
Breathtaking.
Breathtaking. But I guess what you have written about is that you just feel in safe hands when it is an Attenborough documentary.
Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't sensationalize, and he tells you what's going on. He evokes, of course, all our emotions that we have when we experience nature, you know, and the way that nature operates. And so you do really feel like he's a trusted person that you can sit down to and watch or listen to, and you know what you're going to get. And you're going to come away and learn a lot. And every time I watch a David Attenborough documentary, I still come away with something. And he inspires so many, you know, there's so many people, including myself, but many of my friends and colleagues that have gone into a career around conserving wildlife and the environment because of him inspiring us as kids.
I love hearing that even as a professor of wildlife ecology and conservation, you can sit down and learn something from those documentaries, Ewan. You've written recently that also he wasn't off limits to criticism. It's a day of celebration and deservedly so. Yep. But what was the criticism coming his way?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the main criticism really is that, you know, he showed us all the wonders of the natural world, and that's so important because, you know, we need to form connections with things and understand the world to value them. But he didn't overtly really point to what we as people are doing to the natural world. And of course, we know that we're, you know, clearing areas, destroying habitats, we're spreading invasive species around, pollution and so forth. And that was largely absent, really, when you watch all of the early documentaries, even though, of course, that was occurring at the time. But of course, in more recent years, he has been really clear about that. And he even has a witness statement about, you know, what he's seen happen to the world in his lifetime. And I think it's, you know, those criticisms are true, but you could argue that if he hadn't first shown us just all the true wonders of the world and got people hooked, it might have been harder to have those discussions also about what we're losing and what we're doing, but also importantly, the role that we can play in being part of the solution as well.
One could argue that if he'd made himself political, because I guess that's where that sort of criticism might have led, then he wouldn't have been as influential.
Yeah, I mean, exactly right. So I think, you know, as valid as those criticisms are, I think we need to be fair about the fact that you do really need to first start by maintaining and sort of fostering connections with the natural world to really then open up those, you know, important conversations and challenging conversations.
Mm. You're listening to Ewan Ritchie, who's from Deakin University. He's been, obviously, around for the lives of most people on the world. It's hard to imagine a life beyond David Attenborough. This is his birthday and we're going to absolutely hope and wish for him the absolute best and longest life. But what about the legacy? Who's following in his footsteps? Who might be the ones who take the baton and run with it?
Look, I really hope that it's, you know, not one or a few people, that it's many people. And I think we're actually seeing that. And I guess you could argue that with the advent of social media, for all of its problems, it's also opened up great opportunities. And there really are a really large, you know, diverse group of people, you know, gender, culture, and other types of diversity that are voices, because of course, you know, we love David and David's been, you know, fantastic for what he's done. And there is real benefit in having someone that you're familiar with, but we do need to hear, of course, different voices from around the world. And we're seeing that. So I don't think there'll ever be another David Attenborough type person that is this sort of singular voice that carries for so long. I think what we'll see is a real surge in diversity of voices, and we're seeing that across, you know, traditional media, legacy media, but also now new media and so social media. So I think that's a great thing to see, and also more unification of, you know, the arts and sciences, and a lot of collaborations are occurring there too. So I think it's a really wonderful thing, and I think, you know, David can take some credit for that because, you know, many of those people were in fact inspired by him.
Indeed. Ewan, thank you for joining the celebration.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ewan Ritchie is Professor of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin University. We're talking about David Attenborough. He wanted a quiet birthday for his milestone. Didn't get it, of course. I've been asking you about your milestone birthdays, the good ones, the bad ones. Maybe you didn't want someone to recognise it. But Leanne says, Mary, every birthday is a milestone. Celebrate them all. Unfortunately, for some, they don't celebrate many. Don't want to be a wet blanket, says Leanne. This on text from Kylie. My family was separated by border closures during COVID. So when it ended, we all met up for a long table lunch celebrating two 80ths, two 50ths, two 21sts and an 18th. was such a lovely way to put it behind us. What a fantastic story, Kylie. Thank you. We're talking about David Attenborough. As we've said, such an inspiration to so many people, even the youth. We are going to meet a very young man, a climate activist at just 13, who's been inspired by that very special 100-year-old.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Well, Ashan Amir, at just 13, is an author, a filmmaker and a climate activist. In just year five, he made a world record in the Australian Book of Records for being the youngest documentary maker. It was called Generation Green. A couple of months ago, he launched a book as well. And as I say, it's about the climate. He's always been a fan of nature, but the birthday boy has a special place in his young life. Ashan Amir, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
You have done so much in your 13 years. You've written a book. Your debut novel is called Guardians of the Shift, The Coral Quest. I want to talk about that in a minute, but you dedicated it to Sir David Attenborough. Why?
He's really been my inspiration.
In what way? When did you sort of remember realizing who he was and what he was doing?
I think it was maybe at the age of six, I think, that I really really started enjoying it, and he was just a big inspiration, so I decided to dedicate it.
And I believe you've gotten some letters from him, is that right?
Yeah.
Tell me about those. How did they happen?
So the letters came, we went to, the first one, we went to England as just a little holiday trip, and we decided to go to his house. And I just dropped off my letter. I knocked on the door and someone opened it. I just gave them the letter and walked back to the car.
So you knew where he lived?
Yeah, it's online.
Okay. I wonder how many people do that. So you give him the letter and then what happens?
I wait a couple of weeks or month, I forgot. And I thought he wasn't going to respond. But then suddenly he just did.
Okay, so what was in your letter? What did you say to him?
It was mainly about my documentary. I hadn't made a book yet. Mm-hmm. So it was just about like how he was my biggest inspiration, and I wanted to be just like him doing documentaries. Mm.
And so he wrote back to you. What did he write?
Just a couple of words of thanks and uplifting me.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So that's one letter. Did you get any more?
Yeah. Then I wrote a book, as you know.
Yes.
And I sent the book with another letter, just telling him how he's also again my inspiration for writing a book. And I told him he can keep the book. He wrote back, typed this time with a picture, and yeah, that's signed. Yeah.
Where are the letters now? Where do you keep them?
It's hung up on a wall in Hope Island, yeah.
Pretty precious things to have, aren't they?
Yeah.
Why are you such a passionate environment advocate? Where did that come from in your life, Ashan?
Well, I've always loved nature, how it's always in harmony. And you can just look at, it's a little patch of grass anywhere, and you can see an entire colony of ants or just a small grasshopper. Anywhere you look, really, nature is controlling. So we need to protect that. Protect it.
We talked about your book there. It was launched in March. It's called Guardians of the Shift. What is it about?
It's about a boy named Leon who embarks on a quest to save the Great Barrier Reef from some villains that were inspired by man-made destructions, such as pollution, oil spillage, and everything.
Do you have, you know, a favourite animal or species or environment that you're particularly passionate about, Ashan?
I really like the turtle because of its longevity and how it always comes back to the place where it was born.
Mm. What are you going to do today on Sir David Attenborough's birthday?
I'll 100% celebrate it with my friends and, yeah.
Do you want other people your age to be inspired as well?
Yeah,
That's my main goal. I want to inspire people my age.
Thank you so much for joining us, Arshan. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Arshan Amir, just 13, an author, a filmmaker, a climate activist, and inspired by the 100-year-old David Attenborough. Nat in Geelong says, in my 20s, I had a box set of Attenborough's The Life of Birds on VHS. I loved it and I love him. And Lisa wants the ABC to run the Attenborough documentary on how the world has changed since his childhood. I'm sure they'll be thinking about that, Lisa. We have been talking about David Attenborough, a marvellous man. There is another marvellous man we'd like to celebrate today. We've had our eye on him because he's a recently retired Ambulance Victoria paramedic, Sean Whitmore. He's retiring after 2 decades as a flight paramedic on Air Ambulance Victoria helicopters. After 34 years, after saving, no doubt, thousands of lives, he's stepping away from the job. And would you believe he started off as a car sales rep? He joins me now. Hello, Sean.
Yeah, g'day, Mary. How are you going?
Good, good. I must ask about the sales rep. What was the point in time where you realised sales repping isn't for you, saving people's lives is?
I sort of bumbled into the health world, I suppose. I was given a job straight out of work as a car detailer. So just cleaning cars. So this was in 1984. So yeah. The job market was a bit tight at that time. So I just took, whatever I could get and had a plan to do nursing, but it was a very, very loose plan. And I was probably, most 18, 19-year-olds of my era were probably a bit directionless and possibly a little bit lazy, which I definitely fitted into that category.
Made up for it.
Yeah, my school reports would suggest otherwise. I was spectacularly mediocre. So I was called abysmal and irresponsible and all those things that you can't put on a school report these days. But at the time, that's where I found myself. So I repeated year 9, eventually got through, did HSC, got given that job as a car cleaner. And then I actually got sacked from that job. Yeah, the story just gets better, I suppose. But
this is a success story, people, by the way. You got sacked, but then you go into nursing and fast forward a few short years, you have a career that included 580 winch training operations, 41 live winch patient rescues. You've completed more than 700 ventilated inter-hospital transfers of critical patients. Extraordinary. What was it like to be doing that sort of work?
It's one of those things. I sort of fell into that from nursing, so I got to know some of the paramedics when I was working at an outer eastern hospital in Melbourne, working on the triage desk. Started playing golf with them, had a bit of a hit with them, decided, that sounds like it'd be good. It combines being outside with still using some medical knowledge, I suppose. And in my assessments for the job, it said that I sought novelty and variety, which I thought was a bit condescending, but was probably true. And the job did actually offer quite a bit of variety, and that's what keeps most paramedics in the job, is that there is that level of unpredictability, and if you like that, well, that's the job for you. But if you're after really strong structure, it's probably not.
But the pressure, as you say, as well as the variety, is there a moment that sort of sticks out for you in your career that you'll never forget, the pressure and coming through that day?
There's a few, I suppose, because, I ended up having a reasonable repertoire of jobs over 20 years on the helicopter. One was a case where I ended up having to do a cricothyroidotomy on a patient. So
what does that involve?
Well, it involves actually cutting into their neck and putting a tube in, because you can't actually physically get the tube via their mouth. So it's a very infrequent circumstance, but the time, and I've only done one in my entire career, and lots of people go through their careers without doing any, which is really good.
What goes through your mind when you're thinking, this is the day?
Yeah, well, it's sort of, you've got your career dissipation light sort of blinking quite loudly, you know, brightly, and the side of your view a little bit. But it's basically, I think, I had a lot of time to think about that, obviously, because we have quite strong clinical governance systems, and it went through, you know, a number of committees, I suppose, for want of a better word, to be reviewed to see whether what I did was actually safe and correct. But, you know, I suppose what goes through your head initially when you realise that you and the patient are in trouble, I suppose, is that I just thought, how did this happen, and why am I the person to try and sort it out?
Yeah, wow.
But so you have, I mean, for me, I've had a few jobs where I've sat there and thought, I actually have a bit of a wave of nausea where I think this is absolutely massive. But, you know, we have systems and training to get through that. And I suppose, you know, in the aftermath of it, that's what I looked at retrospectively, was to think, all right, well, how can I improve via this? How can the system improve via this? Which there was a couple of things that occurred, some equipment issues that job and another job just prior to that revealed with some of our equipment. Mm. So systems were put in place to change that, and now we do things very differently to what happened on the day with me in terms of our equipment. So,
well, it's that not just the review of the processes, but it's that human ability to face those waves of nausea, as you say, that, you know, so many of us have so much gratitude for. As you step away after 34 years, Sean, what do you want people to understand about the people who do this every day?
I think just what saves you a little bit, I think, in terms of your longevity is you know, being able to talk through things. And and certainly for paramedics these days, the job's a lot busier than what it was when I started. So I think the base load on your brain is probably higher than what it was. Like, the training's better.
Yeah.
The clinical governance is better. All of these things make a more robust system, but it also makes it, you know, it increases the responsibility. Yeah. So,
well, I hope you don't miss it too much in your retirement, Sean.
No, I'll do some private work overseas and have some other interests in wilderness medicine and that sort of thing. So I'll continue to do that.
Well, good on you. And on behalf of everyone listening, thank you for your work, and enjoy it. Enjoy your retirement.
No worries. Thanks very much, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Oh, lovely to talk to you. Sean Whitmore, former paramedic, celebrating some wonderful people today. Thank you. Join me again next week on The Conversation Hour.